Welcome to the Maritime History Program. I'm your host, Brandon Huebner. Our episode today is Episode 6, Khufu's Solar Ship, or Sailing into the Afterlife. Last time we began our look at Egypt by talking about ship representations from the pre-dynastic period. Those, along with the boat graves from the Second Dynasty, that reveal Egypt's early boat technology. Now, it may seem a little strange, but today we are going to start out with the story of a pyramid and the secret that it held for over 4,000 years. As you might suspect, that pyramid is none other than the Great Pyramid at Giza, a monumental structure that was built during the reign of the 4th Dynasty pharaoh, Khufu. Before we can get to the story of that pyramid, though, let's take a few minutes to see how Egypt got up to this point of being able to build such an amazing structure. At the end of our last episode, we had seen Egypt's development up through the beginning of the First Dynasty. Accuracy at this early period is pretty difficult, but it's fairly safe to say that Egyptian pharaohs didn't begin their pyramid-building ventures until the beginning of the Third Dynasty, when Djoser built the Step Pyramid at Saqqara, the first successful monumental structure to be built using finished stone. It seems that the Step Pyramid began as just a traditional rectangular-shaped building, but then it seems that the builder Imhotep continued by adding more mastaba-shaped steps on top of the base layer. These steps gradually decreased in size as they rose higher into the air, which gave the structure the pyramid shape that we instantly recognize today. It's interesting to note, too, that Djoser's royal vizier Imhotep was one of the first recorded architects of ancient times, and among the dozens of titles that were held by Imhotep was that of overseer of the pharaoh's shipyard. So after they completed the first true pyramid, the Egyptians continued to hone their building skills. By the end of the Third Dynasty, the pharaoh had become solidified as the sole focus of Egyptian life. Building the earliest pyramids had also allowed the pharaoh to establish what was basically a command-control societal structure. After Imhotep, the vizier and various other administrative heads became commonplace. The pharaoh used them in conjunction with the religious establishment to direct every facet of Egyptian reality. This top-down command structure was feasible thanks to the early system of national taxation that was implemented in Egypt. This system was where the pharaoh played a ceremonial part, like we described last time, with the following of Horus. That event was recorded on a stone called the Palermo Stone. It's a fragment of a stela known as the Royal Annals of the Old Kingdom of Ancient Egypt. The Palermo Stone records the significant events of different pharaohs that reigned during the 1st through 5th dynasties, so it contains quite a few different pharaohs, and it can serve as a useful reference point for our discussion of early Egypt. In this time span, the Palermo Stone records multiple pharaohs, each going on multiple tours to conduct their census and to tax the people. Given this repetitive nature of the following of Horus, we are forced to ask the questions: what would cause an entire people to submit to the pharaoh so easily? And what eventually led to the point where an entire city would spend the lifetime of a pharaoh preparing one monument for him alone? Both of these phenomena can be explained by the growth of pharaoh's place in the religious trappings of Egyptian society. Obviously, the pharaoh had no qualms about participating in an enterprise that elevated his status from that of a leader to that of a god. And the pharaoh actually played a large part in promoting the growth of his religious role within Egyptian society. The start of this pharaoh as god idea can be traced back to the unification of Egypt, when the second pharaoh chose to assume a title that combined the names of Nekhbet and Wadjet, the vulture and cobra goddesses of Upper and Lower Egypt, respectively. This move to unify the goddesses symbolized his ambition to solidify his place as the lone ruler of a unified kingdom, with the goddesses of both halves serving as his protectors in both halves, and the whole. Additionally, though, this early combination of the pharaoh's image with that of the gods ultimately led to the situation that we outlined above. The people were glad to serve him because he functioned as the go-between to the gods that kept the country unified and prosperous. The pharaoh was the key to upholding Ma'at, which was the Egyptian perception of truth, or justice, or order, in the cosmos and in Egyptian society. So that's just a bare-bones summary of the development of Egypt's society in the early stages of the Old Kingdom. Although, again, it's an amazingly intriguing topic. I do think we've sufficiently laid the groundwork that we can now understand the accomplishment that the Fourth Dynasty pyramids really were in their context. So let's go ahead and meet the Fourth Dynasty pharaohs and discuss their shipbuilding ventures. The first pharaoh of the Fourth Dynasty was named Sneferu, and the title that he adopted as pharaoh indicates both the scope of his ambition and it succinctly proves our discussion about the pharaoh functioning as a god and focal point in Egypt. Sneferu adopted the title Netjer Nefer, which literally meant the perfect god. Quite the claim for a man to make. Anyhow, as I said, Sneferu set out on a pyramid-building campaign, of the type that had to this point in Egyptian history been unheard of, not only in terms of the number of pyramids, but also in terms of their size and the labor and manpower required to build them. Sneferu is remembered as having been responsible for the Bent Pyramid at Dasher, the Red Pyramid, and the Meidum Pyramid. A large part of his ability to build these pyramids was because of his relationship with other nations. And when I say relationship, I mean that the other nations in this equation didn't have much of a choice. Sneferu brought his military might to bear, you could say. In addition to his pyramid building, the Palermo Stone describes him as also being responsible for, quote, the building of Tuatawa ships of merwood of 100 capacity and 60 royal boats of 16 capacity. The Palermo Stone also tells us that he was the pharaoh who oversaw the hacking up of the land of the Nubians and the bringing in of 7,000 prisoners, men and women, and 20,000 cattle, sheep, and goats. Most important for our purposes, the stone also tells how Sneferu saw the bringing of 40 ships of cedar wood, which this is sometimes interpreted as being ships laden with cedar wood. Either way, this description is seen by many historians as being a reference to the land of Lebanon, or Byblos, as it was called in ancient times. Old Kingdom Egypt had some ties with Byblos, and in the future we will take quite a few episodes to look exclusively at this civilization that we now know as the Phoenician civilization, although it played a larger role in the later period of ancient history after the Bronze Age collapse. Byblos and other cities in the Levant were actually a huge part of ancient civilization and the trade that went around the societies of that region of the world. That's for the future, though. The last thing that I'll mention here in connection with Sneferu is the belief that he was responsible for the first boat in history that was christened with a name. This was a 100-cubit cedarwood boat that is, in some interpretations of the Palermo Stone, named, quote, the Praise of the Two Lands, which is another nod to the pharaoh as the unifier of Upper and Lower Egypt, the two lands that are in the boat's name. So as we've seen, Sneferu got the ball rolling for the Fourth Dynasty Golden Age of the Pyramids. But it was his son Khufu who built the Great Pyramid of Giza, one of the seven wonders of the ancient world and the item of focus in today's episode. Before we talk specifics, I'd like to try a little imagination experiment to paint the visual picture of what Giza would have been like at the time of Khufu's death. During his life, he oversaw the building of the Great Pyramid, along with the entire pyramid necropolis at Giza, and what we tend to picture in our minds today when we think of the pyramid there is actually a far cry from what an Egyptian would have seen on the day that Khufu's body began its journey to burial in Giza. This was over 4,000 years ago. Imagine with me, if you will, that we are on board a cedar wood ship docked in the ancient capital city of Memphis. The ship is about 140 feet long. It has a high vertical point to the prow and a stylized arching stern. While there are priests and nobles manning the oars aren't actually in use. Our ship is being towed downriver by a smaller vessel. The priests are symbolic, as is the ship itself, because the main occupant of the ship is the pharaoh Khufu. His body occupies the main cabin, which is an enclosure of cedar wood that would completely shield the pharaoh's body from the outside world. As our ship is towed down the Nile toward Khufu's pyramid necropolis at Giza, the pyramids on the plateau grow larger on the horizon. Recently completed, their white limestone casing stones glisten in the glaring sunlight. We reach Giza and make for a canal shooting off from the main body of the Nile. Were the river at its height during the flood season, we could make directly for the Valley Temple, but since the Nile is in its low season, a canal is connected to the temple gateway into the Giza necropolis. We dock at the Valley Temple, and the ritual which has already begun moves into the next phase, the preparation of the pharaoh's mummy. The mummification process will take 70 days, after which a funeral procession will carry the mummy of Khufu up the causeway that connects the temple to the mortuary temple at the foot of the Great Pyramid. During those intervening 70 days, however, the ships on which we journeyed to Giza will be systematically disassembled and carried up the same causeway for a burial of their own. We will start to talk about that burial and its surviving power here in just a couple minutes. But if we'd been able to tell Khufu that his grave and his mummy would be looted not that long after they'd been sealed, really, but that his funeral ships would remain hidden for millennia, I think that he may have changed his burial plans just slightly. Unfortunately for him, no advice from the future was available at that time. His pyramid has been a fascinating draw for explorers and adventurers since the earliest times. Back in the 9th century, a Muslim ruler famously oversaw the tunneling that hacked into the pyramid face. This dig is cited as the first recorded time that explorers reached the inner king's chamber. But it's also clear that even in the 9th century, they weren't the first to have made it inside the pyramid. Khufu's grave had been robbed long before, and we actually have never found Khufu's mummy to this day still. Fast forward a millennia from the 9th century dig to the famous and probably apocryphal stories of Napoleon's night in the pyramid, and we can still see the aura of mystery that surrounds the Giza necropolis. Our final jump forward through time for this portion of the episode brings us up to 1954, a year when the Egyptian Antiquities Service had drawn up plans to clear away much of the rubble that had accumulated around the Great Pyramid. Over the decades, archaeologists had been excavating the numerous tombs that were scattered around the pyramid necropolis, and the best place to dump that debris was at the foot of the pyramid itself. Well, as you can imagine, sand began to pile on top of the debris, and over time, sand dunes began to build up against the lower reaches of the pyramid's base. This accumulation was the problem that the Antiquities Service set out to correct. Work was understandably slow, as they couldn't risk bulldozing their way through the rubble and inadvertently destroying whatever may have been overlooked by the earliest explorers. Despite this painstaking clearing process, by 1954, they had reached the final stages of the project, and they really hadn't found anything of interest. Then, in the spring of 1954, they got down to the limestone bedrock of the plateau, and they began to discover limestone slabs, which weren't necessarily a major find, but they were at least something, and something new. These slabs were part of a wall that once encircled the entire pyramid, sealing it off from outside entrance, except via the mortuary temple where Khufu's body had been prepared for burial. The existence of this wall was already known before 1954, and the rediscovery merely confirmed the assumption that the wall had originally extended around the pyramid's entirety. Alright, I should confess, I did leave out one crucial fact, and it's a fact that should jump out in the mind of anyone familiar with the ancient Egyptian architect's penchant for symmetry and exactitude. While the three previously known sides of the wall had all extended along the pyramid's base, at the exact distance of 23.6 meters away from the pyramid, this fourth wall was built 5 meters closer to the base, a fact that perplexed everyone except one man, the leader of the project, who was a young archaeologist and architect by the name of Kamal el-Malak. His previous experience at other pyramid sites led him to the conclusion that this wall had been built closer to the pyramid because it was intended to conceal something that lay beneath the plateau's surface. As Malak tells it, he had long been fascinated with the boat pits connected to other 4th Dynasty pyramids. 5 empty boat pits had been found carved into the bedrock outside the mortuary temple at Chephren's pyramid, which was also on the Giza Plateau. Boat pits were also present at other 4th Dynasty pyramid sites, not to mention the 3 empty boat pits that had already been discovered around the base of Khufu's pyramid. This one seemed to be still sealed, or at least that was Malak's suspicion. As his workers continued uncovering the unique wall that ran along the Great Pyramid's base, and as they got down to the bedrock, they made a shocking discovery that confirmed Malak's suspicion. The wall was built atop a layer of compressed rubble and mud that made up a plaster-like surface. Malak was even further surprised to discover that under this plaster surface was a mixture of cement-like mortar that had been used as a binding agent by the Old Kingdom Egyptians. This discovery of mortar and the plaster surface beckoned him to explore further, mostly because the mortar was laid down in a thin line that ran perpendicular to the pyramid and to the enclosure wall. It began on one side of the wall, it ran underneath it, and it emerged on the other side. This peculiar layout and the telltale signs indicated one thing to Malak. Something was buried underneath the wall. This something required mortar to keep it cemented together, possibly sealed. On the same day he discovered the mortar, Malak's workmen uncovered 2 humongous limestone blocks that also ran perpendicular to the wall. One by one, they uncovered more, until they had eventually unearthed 2 gigantic sets of limestone blocks that were laid out in a row and divided into 2 groups, 40 stones in the western group, 41 in the group to the east. The 2 groups, when viewed from above, resembled the keys of a dilapidated piano, laid out in a row and divided in the center. The final piece of the puzzle that prodded Malak into obsession with this find was a cartouche carved into one of the blocks. This cartouche bore the royal name of Djedefre, Khufu's son and the third in line of the fourth dynasty pharaohs. Despite his personal feelings that this particular find was of paramount importance, Malak struggled to gain the service's consent to continue digging. Initially, they dismissed the find as only being part of the pyramid's foundation, not worthy of further examination, time, or money. Malak, though, wasn't one to take no for an answer, and I'm glad that he wasn't, that he was persistent. After bugging the service repeatedly, they finally granted him grudging permission to drill one hole into the eastern group of stones. So on 26 May 1954, that's just what Malak did. The going was agonizingly slow for him, I'm sure. The dig proceeded at a responsibly cautious pace, chinking away bits of the massive stone because they feared splitting it and causing it to crash down on whatever precious treasure or lack thereof lay concealed in the pit beneath. After digging down 2 meters below the surface, they reached a rock ledge. We now know that this ledge ran the length of each side of the huge pit. It functioned as a shelf for the massive covering stones to rest on. Upon reaching this ledge, Malak knew that they were close to breaking through, and he took over digging himself, slowly chiseling away the last few inches of rock to uncover a pitch-black expanse below. Years later, recalling the day that he broke through into the pit, Malak described the moment this way. Quote, "I closed my eyes, and then with my eyes closed, I smelled incense, a very holy, holy smell. I smelled time, I smelled centuries, I smelled history, and then I was sure that the boat was there." His premonition and his sense of smell, I might add, were spot on, for indeed a boat was there in that pit. And not just any boat, but a boat that's among the oldest and is inarguably the largest and best preserved example of a ship from ancient history. Before we get there, it's worth mentioning that Malak's piercing of the boat pit set off 2 events. However, it also set the clock ticking on the preservation process, since ancient wood begins to deteriorate quickly after it's exposed to the elements. Only days after Malak bored the first hole into the pit, a photographer for Life magazine stuck a camera down through the hole and took one of the first photographs of what lay buried on the outskirts of Khufu's pyramid. In the foreground of the photo, one of the ship's pointed oars lays atop the neatly stacked planks. In the background, at the far end of the pit, the bowsprit of the ship juts out above the pile of pieces which have dust and debris strewn across the reed mats that cover them. It was a historic photograph, and one which really didn't indicate the magnificent ship that would emerge from the combined pieces that had lain buried for so long. The task of putting those pieces together again fell to the Antiquities Service's chief restorer, a man named Ahmed Yusuf Mustafa. But Hag Ahmed, as he is called, was forced to wait until the pieces could be removed from the pit, and the process of removing them in a safe manner took several months. A giant shed was erected around the pit, and cranes were used to remove each of the limestone covering slabs. As each was removed, however, the team replaced a similar-sized wooden block wrapped in waterproof cloth over the opening, so as to keep the moisture in the pit and prevent the wood from warping. 6 months after the discovery, the last of the stone blocks was removed, but it would be another full year before Hag Ahmed could begin removing the ship's pieces and preparing them in the restoration shed that had been constructed nearby. By late June 1955, he was able to begin the painstaking process of removing each piece one by one. From the beginning, Hag Ahmed stuck to his process of cataloging each piece as it was removed. He took photographs of each layer as it was taken off of the layer underneath it, and he made a composite photo of the layer so he knew exactly where each and every piece had been located by the men who had buried it. As the removal process moved along, Hag Ahmed began to notice the logical sequence with which the pieces had been arranged in the pit. Appropriate preservation measures were taken to ensure that nothing was lost that could be saved, and after 2 years of work, the pit sat empty, finally. In all, it had yielded 1,224 individual pieces, from the largest of the planks and the bowsprit down to the small decorative details that graced the cabin structure. With the pieces finally laid out in his workshop, Hag Ahmed set about the process of reassembling the ship that was originally intended to be reassembled in the afterlife, if ever. It's important to appreciate the fact that before the discovery of the Khufu ship, almost nothing was known about the internal structure of Egyptian boats and ships. Herodotus makes passing mention of the fact that Egyptian ships didn't have an internal ribbing structure, but some historians didn't believe him. They said it was just another of his instances of playing loose with the facts. What it came down to for Hag Ahmed, then, was that he had to assemble a complete Egyptian ship with the aid of only exterior depictions from other ancient Egyptian sites, and the manner in which the pieces themselves had been arranged in the burial as well. As he began the reassembly process, Hag Ahmed saw repeated markings on many of the individual pieces. Four distinct markings kept reappearing, and it's now thought that these denoted the relative quadrants to which the specific piece belonged. On a smaller scale, most of the pieces bear one of many symbols that were probably affixed as directions for where the piece fit into the ship, though the sign markings haven't been studied in any detail to this point. The Egyptian instruction markings give us a good segue to talk about the major difference between the Khufu ship's construction and the way in which most ships today are commonly constructed. The modern method is to start from the inside of the ship, where a keel is used as the base for a skeleton of ribbing supports, to which planking is then attached. The Khufu ship, like many ships of the Old World, was built in the opposite manner, starting from the outside and working into a strengthening framework without any ribbing support structures. This method is often called the shell-first technique, or the edge-joining technique, both names that are quite literal. The builders would start constructing the hull, or the shell, by joining unevenly shaped planks or strakes together at their long edge, working toward the hull shape that's typical of a boat. The Khufu ship in particular has a flat bottom, rather than a single keel. The Khufu ship's edge-joined strakes are also prime examples of the ancient technique of using a mortise and tenon to lock the strakes together. In this case, the long edges of the strakes had slots cut into them, and the strakes were locked together by inserting a tenon, which was a wooden slat that sat in both slots equally and kept the strakes from slipping. If you've ever put together furniture from IKEA, that wonderful furniture store, then you definitely know what I'm talking about. But if that description of the mortise and tenon joint didn't do the trick, and if you've never put together IKEA furniture, then be sure to check out some of the diagrams that I'll post on my website page for today's episode. Anyhow, all the strakes, all the planks, were secured by these mortise and tenon joints, and reed matter was placed between the edges of the strakes to serve as caulking. since reeds would expand when they were wet, then they worked perfectly as a tight water barrier once the ship was in the river. On the interior side of the hull, a wooden support batten, basically a wooden rod that was flat on one side, was run along the inside seam of each strake edge. Each one then had a V-shaped hole cut into the interior side at regular intervals. The hole didn't pierce completely through. It allowed the builders to further strengthen the plank joining because they could feed rope through the holes that ran perpendicular to each strake edge, and they could tightly secure the wooden support battens along the seams. Again, this is a bit hard to describe with no pictures involved, so pictures really are worth a thousand words when you're trying to describe how things are constructed technically. The design of the Khufu ship was quite ingenious in practice, because once the boat was placed in the water, the wood would swell up, and the lashings along the inside structure would shrink, which tightened the bindings even further and kept the ship watertight for a pleasure cruise on the Nile. Well, probably no pleasure cruising for Khufu, since this ship was his funeral barge. But you get the picture. The construction method of this ship, and likely all early Egyptian ships, was also extremely practical, at least in one sense. The edge joining method that they used didn't require anything to be permanently fastened together, so a ship could easily be taken apart, carried across dry land in a train of pieces, and then reassembled to be put back into the next body of water. Most historians suspect that this method was used by the Egyptians who ventured out into the Red Sea, and in one of our next upcoming episodes, we'll take a look at the plausibility and the archaeological evidence that's been found so far to support this theory. We can't leave Khufu quite yet, though. The sheer size and complexity of the ship is difficult to describe. I know that I'm not doing it justice, so if you want to read more about the ship, on my website I've linked to a really fabulous and detailed book that tells the whole story of the ship's discovery. It factors in the reconstruction, the theories behind its origin, the ancient construction techniques, the role of boats in Egyptian religion. It's a pretty good book, and it's free. It's available on the Boston Museum of Fine Arts website. They have a fabulous library of Giza materials that they have made freely available to the public. So as I said, I have a link on my website if you're interested. Just look for the page connected to episode 6. So the last big thing that I'll mention before we get into the theories about why the ship was built is an idea that I touched on last time. This is the idea that even after the Egyptians had begun building wooden ships, that they still purposefully sought to evoke the style and shape of their first water vessels, the papyrus reed boat. The Khufu ship is a perfect example of this, as the curving ends are beautifully like the papyrus shape. We see this homage to papyrus not only in the ship's silhouette, but also in the small decorative details of a papyrus bud carved into the ship's cabin columns. Also in the imitation rope bindings of a papyrus reed raft that we see on the ship's prow. The Khufu ship then seems to have been constructed with an eye toward tradition, and few traditions are as closely tied with ancient Egypt as are its religious traditions. Getting into this territory now, we must ask the question, what religious mindset drove them to build such a majestic ship? And why would they only use it one time, it seems, and then bury it? That is the indication given to us by the evidence, by the way. Rope markings on certain parts of the wooden pieces show us that it was probably submerged in water for a short period of time, which allowed the wood to swell and the ropes to leave their mark. The reason for the Khufu ship's construction and its religious significance are the subjects of much debate, And despite my intimations earlier that it was the one-time funeral barge for Khufu, we don't know this 100%. I personally think that this theory lines up well with our other understandings of how ancient Egyptians depicted the afterlife. So let's take a quick look at those depictions, and hopefully you can get a good idea of your own opinion of what's going on. Our earliest written evidence of the Egyptian idea of the afterlife comes from what we now call the pyramid texts. These texts were found inscribed on the inside of Old Kingdom tombs and sarcophagi that were dated mostly to the 5th and 6th dynasties. Their detail and their extensive use in royal and noble tombs seem to lead to the conclusion that these texts must have been in existence for at least a decent period of time before they were written down, just like oral traditions have always led to a written tradition afterward. If this all holds water, then we can make a safe assumption that most, if not all, of these religious concepts were in the Egyptian mindset at the time that our pharaoh Khufu was buried in Giza. So how do the pyramid texts line up with the Khufu ship? Let's go ahead and find out. We've already seen in our look at Egypt how the Nile and its cycle of annual inundation shaped the terminology of Egypt's religious expression. The pyramid texts give us a first glimpse at how the water factored in as well. As a whole, the pyramid texts were inscribed on the inside of a pharaoh's tomb to serve as directions for his dangerous journey into the afterlife. In the early Egyptian depiction, heaven was separated from the earth by an expanse of water. Upon death, the pharaoh's path to heaven lay across the water, and the man to get him there was the ferryman in charge of the transportation. Now, those of you familiar with Greek mythology will no doubt note the similarity to Charon, the ferryman of Hades, who carries souls of the newly deceased across the river Styx and Acheron and into the underworld. In the pyramid texts, utterance 263 references the two reed floats of heaven that are placed for Ra, that he may ferry over therewith to the horizon. 300 through 311 describe the ferryman and instruct the pharaoh that in order to gain passage on the ferry, he needs to know the names of the ferryman and the parts of his boat. Though later conceptions of the Egyptian afterlife evolved from this earliest written depiction, the theme of water and journeying through the afterlife on a boat remained pretty consistent. For instance, the coffin texts of the Middle Kingdom moved toward a subterranean idea of the afterlife. It was ruled by Osiris, and it was fraught with peril. This underworld was called Duat, and it was filled with lakes and rivers that had to be navigated by boat. With these two different places, ideas of the afterlife, heaven, and the underworld, we are brought finally to the Egyptian story of the sun god and his perpetual journey from light to dark, perhaps the underlying commonality in the different Egyptian views of the afterlife. The sun god, eventually called Ra, was said to travel in a boat of millions, so called because it needed to contain all the gods and all the souls of the blessed dead. In some later books that depict the underworld, Ra travels in two boats. As he travels across the daytime sky, he lights the Egyptian world with his brilliance, and the Mandjet is his ship. But when he descends below the horizon into the underworld, the Mesektet carries him through Duat to emerge again onto the morning horizon the following morning. This idea that the soul of the pharaoh could join with Ra, that the pharaoh might even be Ra himself, according to some, this is the idea that some have said is the best explanation for the two boats found next to Khufu's pyramid. Wait, two boats? Yes, two boats indeed. Remember earlier in the episode when I mentioned the discovery of two sets of stone slabs in 1954? The eastern pit yielded the Khufu ship that we've just briefly glimpsed, but the western pit was pretty much ignored because of the intense focus on the Khufu ship's discovery. It wasn't until 1987 that an electromagnetic radar survey revealed the existence of a second boat in the western pit. In that same year, archaeologists drilled into the pit to insert a tiny camera and take photos of the wooden planks that were laid out in an organized fashion, just as the first one had been. It wasn't until just recently, though, the year 2008, that a team was able to raise over $10 million to dedicate to the restoration project. In 2011, workers finally began removing the covering stones, and even then it took another 2 years before the boat began to be removed. Only a few short years ago, in June of 2013, removal began on the roughly 600 pieces that the scans revealed to be in the pit. So yes, the second ship is smaller than the first, and experts expect the restoration process to take at least another 4 years. So hopefully in the year 2017, which isn't too far over the horizon, maybe there will be some press and some media of the fully constructed ship. The discovery of this second ship has served to bolster the theories of those who felt that the Khufu ship was intended to carry Khufu into the afterlife. After all, two ships were needed, one for the day and one for the night. And if anyone would know how to piece a ship back together, with the instructions included on each piece, it would be the sun god and his pharaoh, wouldn't it? Alright, I think that is a great place to put a bookmark in things for this week. Next week we will continue our look at Old Kingdom Egypt to see just how far their maritime reach extended. So far, according to them, that it reached to a mythical land, a land called Punt, that we will try to pinpoint on a map. We will also look at some technological innovations of maritime technology, and the remnants of an ancient harbor on the Red Sea. All of that, and even more, next time. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I hope you'll join me again next week at this same time. If you like what you've heard today, visit the program page on boatradio.net. There you can find a link to my main website where I have supplementary maps, images, source lists, and other beneficial supplementary materials. The website also has info about how you can help support the continued production of this free and independent program. Plus, you can find links to connect with the program on social media for other news and interesting info about maritime archaeology and history. I hope you'll join me next week and every week thereafter as we progress through the stories of maritime history together. Until next time, fair winds and following seas. Thanks for listening to the Maritime History Program.